Straight from the heart of Judea, it's Tuesday Night Live with Jeremy Gimpel and Ari Abramowitz.
A lot of you out there may be wondering, what is Tuesday Night Live from Judea? And so I just thought we'd give a little bit of a background into Tuesday Night Live and what that was, and let you know how excited I am about this, how excited Jeremy is about this, because the last Twitter Spaces, we didn't really know. I feel like that old man that's like, Twitter Spaces, what is this new technology? We didn't know what we were really getting into. But the fact that we were able to engage all of you, to hear from all of you, to ask questions, to hear your feedback, Jews all around the entire world sharing that right now during arguably one of the most consequential and tumultuous times in all of Jewish history. It's clear that it's just for such a moment as this that this is all happening. So a little bit of background. Jeremy and I, we've been best friends. Now, you know, we're 44. I don't know if a lot of 44-year-olds are like, he's my best friend. But it is what it is, because since we're 19, that's what it's been. And so we're best friends. And so he's also my commander in the army. We're partners in our mission in trying to share the light and the beauty and the truth of Israel with the world. And so years ago, we decided to go a little bit out of the box and start a television show, and we called it Wednesday Night Live in Jerusalem.
Tuesday
but
night
the theater
Live.
Was booked Wednesday night. So then we changed the title. Do you remember that, Jeremy? Yeah. So we changed the title to Tuesday Night Live in Jerusalem. And that's what it was. And every Tuesday night, we rented out one of the largest theaters in Jerusalem. And and the goal was to just broadcast a very positive, exciting, uplifting message out of Israel. It was really a celebration, because I was shocked when that theater was bursting, packed, sold out nearly every time we did it. And I mean, the energy was contagious. But you could go, if anyone wants to afterwards, or even probably right now, if you wanted to, you could go to YouTube, type in Tuesday Night Live in Jerusalem with Ari Abramowitz and Jeremy Gimpel, and you can see what it was like, what that energy was like. And I always wondered, why are people coming out from all around Israel, all throughout Yerushalayim, all throughout Jerusalem, to experience this show when they live here already? And I think the answer is, you know, you can make aliyah, you can move to Israel, but life takes over sometimes. You got to make a living. You got to take care of the kids. It's the human condition. We're myopic by nature, and it's easy to lose track of the greater picture and of really the celebration of the greatest revolution in world history, which is the return to Zion. And again, what is a revolution? What is a revolution? A revolution, when the minute hand revolves around the clock one time back to the beginning, that is one revolution that goes back to the beginning. And that's why I call the return to Zion the greatest revolution, because never has such a thing happened that a people have been exiled from their indigenous land thousands of years. Not only have they survived, but they have, they've kept together their culture, their faith, their customs. And then, just as all the prophets have been brought back to the land, and it's such a celebration. And so that's what we were doing. We were celebrating. And then, you know, one thing led to another. We did that for a few years, and it was really, really awesome. And now we're like, okay, we're not in Jerusalem anymore, but we are in Judea. And we have this incredible new technology that our beloved friends Eitana and Zev Hecht have been priming and polishing and building up with tremendous Mesirut Nefesh, self-sacrifice. And they said, let's launch it again. And so we said, okay, let's give it a go. Let's see how it is. So that's what we're doing right now. And so we wanted to start off just sharing a little background about the program, the show. I don't know how much this will actually resemble the initial Tuesday Night Live in Jerusalem, but it's a start. And we all know, when we've been talking about this group and meeting about it, we're like, this is going to evolve into something greater beyond what we can really fathom right now at this moment. So this is the beginning, but that doesn't mean that this is the end. I guarantee it's not the end.
Well, I'll tell you, I think one of the secret sauces of the show that we had was there's constant negativity that surrounds Israel, especially now. I mean, the war, the hostages, the God, the genocide claims, the International Court of Justice, constant struggles that we have to go through, and people forget to see the light within the darkness. And I feel like that's our own personal responsibility, Ari and Jeremy, is to like realign people to refocus their attention on the aspects of Israel that are constantly missed, even within this war. I'll tell you, I bought a book called One Day in October, and my wife Tehila is reading it now to my children before they go to bed at night, at least my older children, maybe not my youngest children. And it's just the Sipurei Gvura, just the heroic stories of the Jewish people that as this whole thing was going down on October 7th, there were superheroes that lived among us, and they don't wear capes and they don't have superpowers, but they picked up what they, where they were and what they were doing, and they risked their lives. You know, superheroes in the comic books, there's just nothing really that courageous about Superman. Like, nothing can really hurt him. So that, what's the courage there? These were just simple people that did the most supernatural things. They were beyond the natural. And the story that really touched my heart was, there was a girl named Gali who lived in one of the kibbutzim, and she's a 15-year-old girl, and she was terrified of fire, because before the war, the Hamas would send these balloons that were filled with gasoline in fire. And as the balloons would pop, the gasoline would spread, and it would just light all of the fields around their kibbutz on fire. And for whatever reason, as a little girl, she was just terrified of the fire. And her father one day said, "All right, I'm going to take you to the fire station." And she took her to the local fire station that's in southern Israel. And instead of running away from her fears, he sort of asked her to encounter her fears. Go to the fire station, talk to the firemen, see how they put out fires, see that there's some things that are in our control, and to just encounter the fear of fire from a place of strength and from a place of courage. And then several weeks later, October 7th happened, and her father was a part of the security team. He went out to sort of postpone the disaster that was October 7th, and she found herself alone in the safe room, in the bomb shelter. And you can imagine, a little girl that was scared of balloons with fire, all of a sudden she has hundreds of Hamas terrorists that are shooting RPG missiles and firing and yelling Allah Akbar. I can only imagine the terror that she must have gone through. And for several hours, she's just locked herself in her safe room, hiding under her bed. And at one point she hears that there are Israeli soldiers outside the safe room. And she hears them talking, and they're trying to figure out where to go. And they don't know anything about the kibbutz that they're in. They don't know the names of the roads. They don't know the neighborhoods. They don't know how to get anywhere. And all of a sudden, she realizes that she could help them. And so she opens the door to her safe room. You can imagine just like tremendous courage at this time, as there are still bullets being heard, being shot all around her little kibbutz. And she tells the soldiers that she can help them. She knows where different people's homes are. So what she did is she put on the kibbutz WhatsApp group, "Tell me where you are. If you're alive, tell me where you are." And then people would say, "Okay, I'm in this street, in this number, in the safe room." And then she would tell the soldiers, "All right, you go down the street, you make a left, you make a right, fourth house on the left." And then she became the center of intelligence for all of the military in that kibbutz. This 15-year-old girl was getting all of the WhatsApps from the people in her kibbutzim, and then she was giving out the directions to the soldiers and telling them how to get there in order to save all of the families. And so this little girl saved dozens and dozens of her friends, dozens and dozens of her kibbutz members. And at the end, the soldiers went off and they forgot to rescue her. And she was left there alone. Eventually, her mother was rescued. She was in another safe room. And she's running around looking for her daughter, looking for her daughter. Where is her daughter? Is her daughter safe? Where's her daughter? And they said, "Is your daughter's name Gali?" And they said, "Yeah, my daughter's name is Gali." And she's like, "Oh, she's running the entire Hamal for the military in her home." And she's like, in our home, the intelligence center from her home. And she's like, "What? Really?" But then they saw the soldiers were out. The soldiers actually forgot to rescue Gali. So now Gali is left alone in her safe room after running all of the intelligence for the army, but the army forgot to evacuate Gali. So now her mother, of course, is absolutely terrified, yells at the army to get their act together and go in and save her daughter. They go in, they save Gali, and she has now become the hero of the kibbutz. And, you know, the Jewish people are often, the analogy is used in the Talmud that we're olives. And if you pick an olive off a tree, it's just not very tasty. It's pretty much inedible. You got to do something to the olive. And until you put the olive under tremendous pressure, that's when the greatest part of the olive comes out. That's when the oil comes out. And this war has brought out so much heroism, so much chesed, so much kindness, so much unity. And if we keep all of our focus on all of the disasters that are happening and all the stresses and all the wars, then we forget to see the little spice carts, the little gifts, the sort of silver linings that are around the war.
You know, I got to tell you, we're out here on the Judean frontier, on the deepest settlement into southeastern Judea. And, you know, sometimes we have the honor of having tourists come out here. And inevitably, they are asking, is it dangerous? How do I get out there? I'm really nervous about coming. Which road should I take? And a lot of them don't come. But then, you know, I see these young Jewish men, 17, 18 years old, and they're doing everything they can to get into the best infantry units that they can, combat units that they can, go as deep into Gaza as possible and fight the wars of Israel against the war, against the energy of darkness and evil in the world, putting their lives at risk, knowing it's not like a theoretical, you're joining the army, maybe there will be a war, maybe not. They are joining a war. They know that it's a lethal war. People are dying every day, and they're doing everything they can to fight it.
I think about that all the time. I think about the, what, an 18-year-old kid, what's he doing in America right now? 19-year-old kid, he's at some fraternity party getting drunk, doing stupid nonsense, just wasting his time, wasting his life, partying his brains out,
becoming superbly woke and triggered about everything, literally a snowflake, where the smallest words and microaggressions can trigger an entire world of trauma and therapy. Meanwhile, like, that's what I said to my wife Shayna. I was like, if I could live in a mansion in Great Neck or Wood Neck or whatever the different necks are in New York, with all of his money, or a caravan, a trailer in the hills of Judea, there's no question in my mind, zero question. It would take me zero moments of deliberation. That is exactly what I do. I would live in Judea in a caravan, because I see the quality and the strength of the people here. As a matter of fact, you know, early on in this war, you know, I'm not going to give exact numbers, but there were a lot of these settlements where, you know, 80-90% of the men were called up to the army. And the settlement nearest to us, there was an incident that happened from there was an attack from one of the Arabs on one of the Jews that was driving by. And this is when most of their husbands are at war and they're home all alone, just days after watching the worst genocidal massacre of Jews since the Holocaust. That really, if we're going to be honest, it sent fear down the shiver down the spine of every Jew everywhere in the world. And any God-fearing normal person had their head spinning in absolute terror at what happened there. And these women took their children out, walked out of the settlement, and stood right in front of this Arab village that the terrorist came out of, and sang songs to Hashem, spiritual songs, songs about Israel, songs of peace, but from a place of real strength with their children all around them. And I know this happened because I was there with my weapon ready, protecting them, along with just a few other soldiers, surrounded by hostile Arab villages. And I would have said, wow, these women, you know, there's a saying, Bizchut Nashim Tzadkaniot Yavo Geula, in the merit of the holy women of Israel, the righteous women of Israel, redemption will come. And I never really understood, experienced my understanding of that idea until I saw that happen. There's just, this has brought out a tremendous amount of strength.
Well, I would say also, aside from the beautiful sides that are in the war must get us to ask questions. We have to refine ourselves, meaning as a believer, that God runs the world. That means that everything that happens to us happens for us. That means that everything that happens in this world is there in order for us to grow, in order for us to learn, in order for us to emerge stronger and to grow into the people that we were created to be. And about a month ago, Ari and I went down south to visit the communities there, to see the actual come of the massacres of October 7th. We wanted to see that with our own eyes. I felt like, you know, the tragic consequences of the disengagement from Gaza, it's not enough to just watch it on a screen on my phone or on a television screen. I want to see it with my own eyes. And I'll tell you right now, I think that the trip down south should be mandatory for every lover of Israel. Everyone that lives in Israel and every visitor that comes to Israel, it should be like a march of the living. The people that go to Poland and to go to Auschwitz to visit the camps, it should be a mandatory trip down south. Instead of visiting Auschwitz and saying never again that in Europe, people need to go down to Kibbutz Be'eri and realize that never again in Europe is an important message, but never again in our own country in Israel is far more important.
I just want to say one thing, Jeremy. You know, I'm following the news very carefully. I'm watching the interviews and the haters of Israel speak. And one thing that has just struck me is that I'm constantly hearing about the inhumanity of Israel, the genocide of Israel. It's nobody ever mentions the horrific massacre of October 7th. It's like taboo to bring it up, to recognize it, to talk about it. It's all about Israel's war, despite the fact that it is, quote unquote, the most humane war in the history of warfare, as far as doing everything Israel can do to avoid civilian casualties. And the reason I said, quote unquote, is because I actually don't think it is so humane, because a lot of these people are not actually innocent civilians. Those that are, we really do need to try our very best. But really, if anything happens to them, it's on Hamas that are using them as human shields in the most cynical way possible, knowing that the complicit legacy media around the world is all too eager to use. It's like a layup and a dunk. Pippen to Jordan, that is Hamas to the legacy media as far as setting Israel up, and it doesn't matter what we do.
Well, I mean, okay, well, that's sort of diverting the conversation to another line, but if we realize that, of course, they're not talking about October 7th, because then we have a justification to do what we need to do to defend ourselves. But if you really think about the axes that are being formed right now on an international level, you think about there's a war, there's a standoff right now, and it looks like Israel and Iran, something is about to break, something's about to give right now. But when you see that there's actually a bigger world war that's happening, there's two fronts here. There's Russia, China, Iran, North Korea, Yemen. I mean, you talk about the forces of evil in the world. Can you imagine if we had to live under China or under North Korea? But all of the bad guys have come together on one team. And here we have then the United States, Europe, I guess Western civilization, the land of the free relatively. And America is doing everything it can to tie Israel's hands behind its back, even though it's so irrational for them to do such a thing right now. They're at war with Russia and the Ukraine, and yet still they're tying Israel's hands behind our back. And so if you see what's happening here, though, it's kind of turning full circle now. It seems as though all of the nations, in one way or another, are positioning themselves against Israel. And in fact, that just might be our destiny. And when you go to Be'eri, which is the kibbutz that I went to, and you see the destruction, and when I was there, the smell of death was still wafting through the air. I mean, there was one woman that just turned right next to me and threw up because the smell was so gross. And you look up in Israel, and you see the words "Hutar Lirsum," which means it's permissible to announce the death of another soldier. And we see more and more of our children that are being killed in Gaza. And we think, gosh, the foundation of the state of Israel was created with the purpose to be a free people from oppression in a country where Jews can be safe, to be a safe haven for Jews. And obviously, the lesson of October 7th is that we can't be that. We can't be a safe people in our land right now. October 7th exposed that the greatest Jewish enterprise in modern history was built upon faulty foundations. And we're experiencing the earthquake that has shaken us and broken us. And now we have to rebuild. We have to rebuild from the foundations. A total Zionism founded on the idea that Jews are here in order to be safe. Honestly, right now, it's not safe in Israel. So what are we doing here? It means that we need to reorient ourselves. Our political leaders were so wrong. Our courts were so wrong. Our intelligence agencies were so wrong. No one knew that they were building 500 miles of tunnels underneath Gaza. How could the Mossad, the Shabak, the greatest intelligence, the most sophisticated technology, all of these people were wrong? Every branch of leadership in Israel was so disastrously wrong. How? I mean, I don't know what to say. But for me, it seems as though there is one word that is always missing from every conversation, from every news article, from everything that's in the media, from everything that's coming out of our leaders' mouths. There's one word. It's the littlest of all words, but it's the word that means everything. And to me, that word is God. Hashem is never brought into this conversation. And it's crazy. For 75 years, the one thing that makes sense has been totally absent. The one little world that means everything has been absent from all of Israel's plans. How have we, the Jewish people, taken Hashem out of our destiny to be here in the land of Israel? And if we don't wake up to that reality, then, I mean, do we really think, do the Jewish leaders in Israel really believe that the Jewish people have come back to the land of Israel after 2,000 years, and we're going to implement policies that are in direct contradiction to the morals of the Torah, to the vision that the prophets gave us, and we're going to be successful? Do we really think that that's going to work? Obviously, that's not going to work. Now we have to align ourselves with the vision that our ancestors had. There is one thing that kept the Jewish people united. It was our hope that one day we would come back to this land and rebuild our country. And you think about it, we have this recorded history, this intergenerational collection of life lessons and wisdom. And the conclusion is, let's act as a nation in total contradiction to our Torah, totally in contradiction to the guidance of the prophets of Israel. And that's going to be our formula to success. Now it's time we have to sort of fuse this into something more beautiful. Our leaders could not have been more wrong. They were arrogant and they were blind. And now we have to sort of wake up. We need a new paradigm. And so, you know, right now I would say that until now, it's like the main purpose of Israel was to create a godless state with peace now. That was the goal. Peace now, whatever it takes. Hostages now, peace now, give up land, whatever we need to do. And it's like, really, we're going to godless state, peace now. And I remember the most striking image in the kibbutz of Be'eri that I saw was the house was totally destroyed, blood on the walls. And there's like a peace now flag hanging from the banister at the entrance to the home. Could we have been more wrong? Those people were peace activists and the enemies of Israel came to attack them more than anyone else. And so Shlomo HaMelech says that without a vision, the nation will perish. Belo chazon, I forgot the sentence in Hebrew.
It's okay, just go ahead.
Iparam. And so that's it. Without vision, the nation will perish. Right now, our job, every one of us, all of us, need to now build a new vision for the future of Israel. And it can't be based on godlessness, and it can't be based on peace now. And that's what this was all about. This war broke our paradigms. It broke our worldviews. It shattered us. It humbled us. And then from these broken vessels, we need to build bigger vessels to contain a greater light.
Yeah. And, you know, I want to share, Jeremy's talking about peace now. A lot of you may not know. Could you raise your hands if you've heard of Peace Now, the organization Peace Now? Okay, I guess I don't know how to view hand raises or, okay, there's some thumbs happening there. Good. Fists, got it. So a lot of you have heard of Peace Now because, you know, you could be like, whoa, what do you have against Peace Now? Well, you don't want peace now? And it's this co-opting of language that is so infuriating that I have to be like, no, I don't want peace now. There's nobody that wants peace more than the Jews of Judea, than the Jews of Samaria, than the Jews of the land of Israel, than the Jews of the world. Of course we want peace. But when you're going to a genocidal jihadist army. They call this the 20-year war, meaning we left Gaza in 2005, and they've just been building up and building up and building up with a lot of patience, constantly ready and preparing themselves for this war. They are in a long-term war, and when we say we want peace now, they hear weakness now. Weakness now. We'll do anything for peace. We have to say no. You want war? Obviously, we want peace. But if you want war, we are ready for war. We'll fight this war for 1,000 years. We will never give up on this war. And just like every other time that we have fought you since the return to Zion, we will be successful because Allah is with us, because God is with us. And if you want to be with God, then you can be with us too. But that's the language we need to speak. Because the fact is that the first verse of the Torah, it says, Bereshit bara Elokim et hashamayim ve'et ha'aretz. God, in the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. And then the Rashi, the first Rashi, the greatest sage in history, he said, what does he say? Why does the Torah begin with this verse, with the story of creation? If it's a book of laws, it should begin with the first law. And the answer he gives with unbelievable prophetic insight, he says, what does this mean? Why is this happening? Because in the end of days, the nations will come against the people of Israel and say, you have stolen this land. And you are to respond and say, God created the world. And he gave the land to whom he pleases. He gave us the land of Israel. That is the only argument. We could talk about the League of Nations and the United Nations, and we could talk about the fact that, hey, you know, we actually won an actual war. They launched a war against us and we won. For thousands of years, that was reason enough to call the land ours. There was a war and we won. Okay, so let's say it was yours for a hundred thousands of years. We won. These are all arguments you can make, but essentially they're all superficial. The deepest, only real argument is that God created the world and God gave us the land of Israel. Now, a lot of you in this group may say, okay, I may believe that, but what am I going to do? You know, like, these are secular people. They don't, the European Union, they don't respect that. One second. Can you guys hear us? I certainly hope so. Okay, we're back there. So, the where was I? Do you remember where I was, Jeremy? Before your son called us on the phone? Anyways, the argument of God gave us the land, when they say, oh, they're secular people, well, then we have to talk about that. We are here as a nation that are meant to be a nation of spreading light and teaching to the world. And so we need to say, you don't believe in God? Let's talk about God. Let's talk about the very test. We are a living testimony to the fact that God exists, because all of you in this group know that we lack the very basic survival instincts that any other nation would have. There's no reason that we should be have survived to this point, because we tend to always turn against our allies and our friends, seek our enemies that want to kill us, seek their love and their friendship. We have very little survival instinct. The fact that we exist in any capacity is the greatest testimony to the God of Israel and his promises to us being true. So we could try to make this group where we're just talking about, hey, did you see that Russia has set up a police station in Syria that's upping the state? And this is all stuff we need to talk about, but it needs to be seen through the prism that this is all going somewhere, that this is being orchestrated from above, that this is not random, and we don't need to play realpolitik and be practical on the deepest level. We have to have clear principles and visions of the way this is playing out. Jeremy's pushing me out of the way.
Well, I'm just saying that, like, how could Israel have been so stupid? That's really the question here. And in the book of Proverbs, the wisest of all men said, Rashid Chokhma Yirat Hashem, the beginning of wisdom is the fear of God. And once you kind of, like, take God out of it, you just become stupid that you can't imagine 100 miles of tunnels. We're giving them billions of dollars. Come on, bring in some Gazan workers. We had no idea that they were planning this. Like, how stupid could we be? And imagine, God forbid, if October 7th would have happened in Shiloh, it would have happened in Samaria or in Judea. What lessons would have been learned? I can already hear the absolutely backwards left-wing media in my ear. It's the settlers. It's the settler violence that instigated the massacre. It's their fault for being in Judea and Samaria to begin with. We shouldn't even be in Judea and Samaria. We need peace now with a Palestinian state right now. Look at this massacre. It's our fault. We shouldn't be there. Talk about the exact wrong lessons. You could just see it happening. We would have made the exact wrong deduction from that. But thank God October 7th didn't happen in Judea and Samaria. So now at least we have a chance, because a was revealed to us. We weren't attacked because we were settlers. These kibbutznikim were not right-wing. They were the most peace-loving, coexistent, pro-Arab people in all of Israel. And the war in Israel is not about Judea and Samaria, what the world calls the West Bank. This war is not about 1967 because Kibbutz Be'eri was established in 1946. Any Jewish independent square mile in Israel is a settlement in the eyes of the Hamas and in the eyes of the jihad. This war isn't about politics, and it's not about border. There isn't a single map in Gaza that shows an Arab-Palestinian school with a map with just Judea and Samaria as a Palestinian state. That does not exist anywhere. They have all of Israel on their maps. In every single home in Gaza, all of my soldier friends, as every home, doesn't just have one picture of the Temple Mount in Jerusalem. Every home has a picture on their wall, a magnet on their fridge, on their books from school. It's a murderous society that is hell-bent on destroying all of Israel. And so October 7th, the murder, the torture, the children, the rape, the hostages, it's like forcing us to encounter reality. We have evil in the land. And that evil has been programmed and religiously indoctrinated to hate Jews in a way that, honestly, we can't even understand. We can't forget the exuberance, the glee as the Gazans were celebrating our massacre, we're parading our dead bodies through their streets. It's like, what, make a Palestinian state retreating from more land with a delusional hope that that's now going to bring peace now? That would be nothing less than national suicide.
Okay, I want to open up to questions. I have a lot more that I want to say and that Jeremy wants to say, but right now I'm seeing all of these names and all of these faces, and I'm just really yearning to hear from you, to hear your thoughts, your questions. We could interact a little bit. That's the most fun. I have a story I wanted to share about peace now, but Jeremy keeps cutting me off, but that's okay. Anyways, Etana, with your blessing and permission, could we open up to some... system questions?
Yeah, absolutely. So just raise your hands if you want to ask a question, then we'll call you guys up, hopefully one at a time. Meanwhile, I want to say thank you to Tino and Spike for helping me co-host these spaces, and welcome everybody. And yeah, Ari, you can continue telling us what you wanted to say until we get some hands up.
Okay, great. I wanted to say the idea that I don't want peace now. When I see the words now written in red almost about anything at this point, I get like shivers down my spine. I get a little bit nauseous. Like I start to feel ill. I want peace forever. That's what we need to be aiming for. Not shalom achshav, shalom lanetzach. Peace forever. And if we don't have that in mind, then we're constantly going to miss the mark.
It's also a very Western thing. You know, now, fast food, everything immediate now. I also get very upset because it's a nuanced thing and it's not really cool to object to it. But you walk through the cities of Israel anywhere and you see these posters up that say, bring back our soldiers, bring them back now. Maybe if it said, Hamas, send them back now, that's one thing. Let us make Hamas send them back now. Let us so beat Hamas into absolute oblivion, beat them down with such a merciless fervor that Hamas is begging us to take them back. That's a poster I could get behind. But bring them back now, the implication is make any deal you have to do, do whatever you have to do. It doesn't matter how many soldiers and how many innocent Jews are going to die further down the line because of the horrific deals, just like the one that freed Sinwar, that orchestrated this entire massacre with Shalit deal. I don't want to make any more deals with them. I want to shake hands with the greatest, darkest evil in the world right now. I want to destroy that evil. I don't want to shake hands with it and make covenants with it. Do we have any questions yet, Etana?
Yes, we do. Brigida, go ahead.
Hello. I wanted to say, if I hear the people yelling peace now, I think, yeah, that's great, but the others, they don't want it. So it's so stupid. I know Israel people, they wanted peace always, and it doesn't help that the others don't want peace, because they want the whole country. They don't want a two-state solution. They want whole Israel, Jews away, Christians away, everything. And I don't get why the European countries are so stupid. Do you have any idea?
Okay, so first of all, thank you so much for the question. We're having trouble hearing you, so I hope I didn't just interrupt you or cut you off. But, you know, you said you don't understand how they're so stupid, how the Europeans and the West right now is so stupid. And I actually don't think that it's stupidity. And, you know, we could look back at all the way back at history and understand that this is essentially a spiritual war. And when all the way, you know, there's an actual midrash, meaning an ancient Jewish teaching, that I think exposes what's really happening, because you could so easily look at Europe and the secular enlightenment and this quest for equality and equity and freedom and bringing in immigrants to allow for assimilation and peace. And all of their values are literally antithetical, the very opposite of the jihad, of Hezbollah and of Hamas. Yet they seem to be such close, tight-knit allies. So how are they such allies when their values are completely antithetical to each other? And I think the answer really goes all the way back to the story about Ishmael. Now, according to Jewish understanding, the Torah understanding, there was Abraham. Abraham had two sons, Isaac and Ishmael. Isaac is the father of the nation of Israel, and Ishmael is the father of the Arab world and later of Islam, but the Arab is Ishmael. Isaac then had two sons, Jacob and Esau. Esau is the father of the West, of replacement theology. If you know what replacement theology is, it's the Catholic Church and their theological position that God gave up and his covenant with Israel and the Jewish people. He decided, no, I don't love Israel anymore. The Catholics are the new chosen people, and God has rejected and hates the people of Israel. That is Esau, the West, the Roman Catholic Church, that sort of a vein that of Western anti-Semitism. And the other son was Jacob, and that's the father of the 12 tribes of Israel. Anyways, now that that's been said, so the story is that Ishmael, the father of the Arab world, goes to Esau, his nephew, and says, listen, this is what we have to do. I will kill my brother, and you kill your brother, and together we're going to take over the world. Meaning Ishmael is saying, I'm going to kill Isaac, and you, Esau, you kill Jacob. And together we'll take over the world. There will be no more nation of Israel, no more light. Put out all the lights. And Esau loves this idea, and they shake on it. Ishmael gives his daughter in marriage to Esau. But it says that in his heart, Esau was saying, once we do this, Ishmael, the Europeans were saying in their hearts, once we do this, Hamas, Hezbollah, we're going to kill all of you. And Hamas, Hezbollah, the Arab world, Ishmael was saying in his heart, once we do this, Esau, I'm going to kill you. And I think that that's really the situation. There's no real love between Europe and the jihad and Hezbollah and Hamas. They just both have their eyes on the source of their greatest resentment and jealousy and hatred, which is Israel. And that's what this war is about at its core.
Well, that's what I want to talk to you. I get a lot of strength when I look at these ancient prophecies, these ancient teachings that were written so long ago, before humanity had running water. And it spoke about realities that are directly impacting our lives today. Like, they are speaking to the headlines in the news today. And if we can internalize that Jewish history is guided. It's a directed reality that must be, that will be. Every force known to humanity has tried to extinguish the fire of the Jewish people. And beyond all reason and all logic, we're back in the land of Israel again, as promised by every prophet in the Bible. And really, a great light came into the world in 1948. And it's still something that we, the nation of Israel, in the land of Israel, we're still processing it. I mean, do we really understand what it means that the Jewish people have returned to Eretz Israel after 2,000 years? It's beyond. So you have to stand in awe at the mystery of Jewish destiny as we're watching it unfold before our very eyes. I mean, we saw in Last Generation the vision that Yechezkel saw, a generation of mass graves in dry bones and ashes, and then from that, a resurrection of the state of Israel. We've seen the laws of history and the laws of nature bend and break with Jewish history, unlike any other history of any other people. And yet still, somehow, there is a perfect balance of free will. It's been maintained. We have the opportunity now to ignore our destiny, to choose our destiny. People have the chance now to side with rapists and murderers because they're stronger and they're scarier, or they have the opportunity now to stand with truth. But we now have a choice as a nation to redirect the ship, to the course that we want to take it towards. Because if not, it's like right now Israel is heading towards the Niagara Falls, and we have to chart a new course. So what is the new destination? What is the course that we're trying to chart? I think if you ask every Jew in the world, what's the purpose of being a Jew? Everyone. It's amazing. Ask the left-wing female rabbi woke in from San Francisco and ask the ultra-Orthodox rabbi in Bnei Brak, what is the purpose of being a Jew? From right to left, Orthodox to Reform, every Jew knows the purpose of Judaism is tikkun olam, to fix the world. But that mantra is only half the verse. The full verse is tikkun olam b'malchut Shaddai, to fix the world through the kingdom of God. That has to be the foundation. We're not here to just be a safe haven. We are here to build something the world has never seen before. That's the only foundation that this Jewish enterprise can be built upon and that will endure forever. That's the only vision that will bring peace forever. Our goal has to be to build a country inspired by the vision of the prophets, guided by the Torah. We have to build a country that fosters a society that's worthy of being a dwelling place for Hashem's presence on earth, a place that is so beautiful that it illuminates the entire world. That was always our collective vision for the future of Israel, our ancient dream that all of us believed in. That's what we prayed for. That's what our ancestors died for. And right now, 75 years, Israel has been heading in one direction. And this war has humbled everyone. And that's a good thing, because none of us can begin to understand the ways of God. We are not commanded to understand the impossible, but we are commanded to believe. To believe with complete faith that the Jewish people have a destiny in the world. And that destiny is unfolding right now. October 7th did not happen to us. It happened for us. It happened so that we would wake up and return us to the path that will bring us to victory and to redemption and to peace forever. And so that's my prayer, that's my hope, that's my blessing to us all, because logic has it that Russia, China, America, Europe, all of them right now have found a common enemy, a common kid in the playground to pick on. And so the nations are now lining up against Israel. And so in the world of politics, in the world of logic, we don't stand a chance. But with Jewish destiny behind us, we are, I believe that the soldiers that we've seen in Gaza in this generation are the greatest Jewish warriors in Jewish history, greater than the Maccabees, greater than David's mighty men. We've never seen a generation so brave, so courageous, so self-sacrificing. It's truly historic.
And there's really no way to understand it other than divine intervention. You know, because on the one hand, I look at the world and I think most Jews were expecting the whole world to be so repulsed and reviled and shocked and disgusted at what they saw October 7th that the whole world would stand with Israel. And then all of a sudden, even before Israel's response at all, there are, you know, hundreds of thousands of people marching through the street. In Australia, they were saying, gas the Jews. I mean, it was like so.
They were saying that before we even retaliated.
Before we even retaliated. That's right. Before we even retaliated. And so, you know, they say that when it came time for the 10 plagues in Egypt, that Pharaoh's free will was taken from him. And in that he was able, he saw these, you know, these intervention of the natural order of things to where hail was falling from the sky with fire within it, the water turned to blood, these unbelievable plagues. And so in order to facilitate all of the 10 to be implemented, Pharaoh's free will was taken from him. And my understanding is that it was taken from him in the sense that it was actually given back to him. Because when you see nature flipped on its head, well, then of course you're going to throw up the white flag. But this just recalibrated it for him, that it gave him the normal free will that he would have. And so I feel like that's what's happening in the world right now. People are seeing this evil, and they're able to have the audacity, if it's within their hearts, to be able to say, like, you know what? I'm actually with them. I'm with that.
Well, look, I look at Western civilization right now, and I expect nothing more of them. They have sacrificed their families for their careers. They've sacrificed their health for junk food. They've sacrificed their meaning for pleasure. They've sacrificed their God for politics. They've sacrificed everything good for everything bad. And so for their moral judgment to be standing with the Hamas because they're scarier and they're hoping that appeasement with the Hamas or the jihad will somehow bring peace, it's... we have no one to rely on.
Literally,
you
go to
the West,
a campus in America, and they could be calling for the genocide of Jews, wipe Israel off the map. You'll be thrown off campus if you misgender someone and you don't respect their pronouns.
And so what's happening right now is it's really a refinement of our emunah. Do we really believe that God is with us? Or are we just checking our broccoli for bugs because that's our religion? That's really the question here. We're all now being refined, and like the truth is coming out. Meaning, do we stand for what's right and what's true because it's right and because it's true? Or are we going to bend to the what the majority want or what people want? Because the Jews have never been in a majority. Abraham was alone. That's why he's a child of Abraham. He was an Ivri. What does the word Ivri mean? It means on the other side. He was on one side, and the entire world was on the other side. And he looked at them and said, all of you are worshiping sticks and stones, and I worship the one true God, the oneness of the universe. All of you are wrong, and I'm right.
And that's why I feel like this time between October 7th and today has been an opportunity for refinement, where every person is able to say, where they fall, where do they stand? There's a line in the sand, and you could say who you stand with, because the prophets of Israel said, for example, Zechariah, he said, when the righteous of the nations will attach themselves to the house of Israel on that day and be for me like a nation. What does it mean to attach yourself to the house of Israel? It means that when the whole world is turning against Israel, you stand in line for Israel. You say, for all intents and purposes, I'm a Jew also. I'm going to put the yellow star on my sleeve. I'm going to hide a Jew in my basement, knowing that if I'm caught, I will end up in the gas chambers of Auschwitz right next to that Jew. When you tie your fate into the fate of Israel and you cast your lot with the Jewish people, that is tying your fate in with the Jewish people. That is attaching yourself to the house of Israel. And I'm sure a lot of you in this group that are non-Jews that are here tonight, you're exactly in that. Okay, we're running low on time here. Hey, Tana, do we have time for one more question, or should we wind it down?
I think Scarlett's had her hands up for a while, so let's let her say her piece, and then if you want, you can end it off.
Okay, great. Scarlett.
Hello. Nice to meet you all. I'm from the United States, and I'm a Christian, and I wanted to say two things. Number one, I never knew why I was encountering Catholics that were so anti-Israel. I enjoyed hearing what you had to say. I can quote them Bible verses from the Old Testament, from the New Testament, all of which support Israel, all of which say God loves Israel, Israel be saved, Israel is his chosen people. And they just skip over it. They don't want to hear that it's in the Bible. I mean, it's in their Bible and they don't want to hear it. I don't understand that. It's like they were brainwashed. Number two, also, did you know Palestine applied to become a member of the United Nations today? In case you don't know that, it was very disheartening to see that. That's all I had to say.
Scarlett, thank you so much for that. Yeah, all I can say, I don't remember who the musician was. Maybe it was Bob Dylan, but he said, you see what you want to see and you disregard the rest. if you have this very deep-seated, multi-generational, theological belief in your heart, spiritual position, that God hates the Jewish people, that he has nullified his covenant with Israel, you know, the God that does not lie, that does not change, he has somehow nullified his covenant with the people of Israel and chosen Catholics to be the new chosen people, they're not looking for the verses that show them anything other than what they believe and what they want to believe. They're seeing what they want to see and they disregard the rest. Regarding Palestine applying for the state, that's just, it's rich, you know, it's just a, it's perfect for these times, times where the lies are truth and the lies are so thick and tangible that you can feel them. There never was an Arab state of Palestine. I don't need to go into the whole history. You all know the history.
No, but I want to say something about the Palestine of the United Nations. So many people are scared about it. Well, what about if this happens in the United Nations? What if the United Nations condemns Israel? And don't we get it yet? It doesn't matter what the nations say. It matters what's right, what's true, and what's moral. If the Jewish people follow God and we follow the truth, nothing else matters. The United Nations can gather together and call each other Harry. They can call each other Palestine, call each other whatever they want. As long as the Jews are in Judea, we are a living testimony that God runs the world and not the United Nations. It doesn't matter what the nations do. It matters what Israel does.
All right. So we're going to, on that note, thank all of you. Please feel free to reach out to us, to reach out to Jeremy. You could direct message Jeremy on Twitter. You could send us messages, you know, my email address. Could we share that
here?
Yeah,
of course.
My email address is jeremy@thelandofisrael.com.
Oh, thanks
a lot. I'm just kidding. No, ari@thelandofisrael.com.
Very good.
Jeremy is jeremy@thelandofisrael.com. We'd love to hear from you. And stay strong. Stay connected. Send us your questions, your thoughts, and we look forward to seeing you, please God, next week.
Thank you, Spike. Thank you, Tino. Thank you, Aitana. It's been a pleasure.